Hello, everybody. Welcome to All That Is Breastfeeding. As you can see here, I have many co-authors, and I would like all the co-authors in the room to please stand up so you know who else to blame for this. Is this going to continue like this? I guess I have to stay in the corner. No, that doesn't work either. Can somebody call somebody out in the hallway to see what's going on here? Hello? Okay. Don't take this off my minutes. Is it okay now? In any case, so you saw who some of the people who are involved in this study. This has been quite a monumental effort, and we've been looking very carefully at introducing the 10 steps to successful breastfeeding in hospitals in North Carolina. And we tried to have a very heavy evaluation component so we would learn from something from this that we could share with you all. Conflict of interest, none to report except that I've been pushing the 10 steps since birth, its birth, and I have written on it often, so I am a bit prejudiced about the 10 steps. Okay, we'll be differentiating between the 10 steps and BFHI. Hopefully when you leave here, you'll be able to explain the potential impact of the 10 steps. And it's not one of our written objectives, but I would like that we also would be able to discuss the results from the study of hospitals serving low-wealth populations and what that might mean as we go forward in terms of programming. So the 10 steps. How many people here have the 10 steps fully memorized? Okay, how many people here have know one or two of the 10 steps? How many people here never heard of the 10 steps? Okay, so we'll talk about it a little bit. Back in 1988-89, 10 practices were, I can't go backwards, 10 practices were developed that basically break down the barriers to breastfeeding in hospitals. So these 10 practices would create an enabling environment such that if a woman wished to breastfeed, she could actually succeed with her intention. The first two steps are that there should be written breastfeeding policy that is routinely communicated to all. All healthcare staff, number two, should be trained in the skills necessary to implement the policy. Logical so far. Three and four, inform all pregnant women about the benefits and management of breastfeeding. Management may be a passe term these days, but remember we're back in the 1980s. Fourth is to help mothers initiate breastfeeding. What is in parens is what we have added through experience. By immediate skin-to-skin and by supporting baby-led and mother-led first latch, within, it used to say a half an hour, we know that an hour now may be needed for some babies. Number five is show all mothers how to breastfeed, if they need to be shown, and how to maintain lactation even when they should be separated, which includes hand expression of their milk. Every mother has the right to know hand expression. Give newborn infants no food or drink other than human milk, unless medically indicated. WHO has since said the first choice for feeding is breastfeeding at the breast, second choice express the mother of the baby's milk, and the third choice would be donor milk. Seven is practice rooming in. That means the mother and baby are together 24/7. Eight, encourage breastfeeding on demand. And the word demand is frequently misunderstood. This does not mean, say, breastfeed now. On demand means when the baby sends out the cues that it is time. And also when the baby sends out the cues that it's already satisfied. The feeding cues and learning those feeding cues are very important for long-term breastfeeding success. Number nine is don't mess things up by giving artificial nipples. And number 10 is foster the establishment of breastfeeding support groups and refer mothers to them. So actively, we at the hospital should be making sure there's groups out there, forming them as need be, and then refer women actively to them on discharge to make sure that there's a continuum of care after they leave. So those are the 10 steps. And you can see it's logical quality of care. There's nothing here that's weird unless you were trained in the Western medical system, in which case all of them seem a little bit odd. So the brief history of the 10 steps in BFHI. Well, the 10 steps were developed around 1986 to 1988. There's about 3,000 myths about who developed them, but I know the truth. It was Audrey Naylor and Margaret Kanka. Audrey Naylor was then running something called WellStart in California, and Margaret Kanka was at UNICEF, had worked in Kenya and Uganda, and together they put these 10 steps together. and they were presented to the world at one of the pre-Innocenti conferences that was held at Georgetown. And that proceedings is out, so if you want to see where they really were first presented to the world, it's in that proceedings that's cited there. In 1989, WHO and UNICEF actually published them in a book, which is still the classic on the issue. In 1990, the Innocenti Declaration was written. Again, people in the crowd who do not know about the Innocenti, please raise your hand. Okay, there are a few. So I'll just mention, this was a groundbreaking conference put on by WHO and UNICEF in this wonderful old building in Florence, Italy, in which 30 countries signed on to do four activities. 30 countries said that by 1995, they would have a national committee that was across disciplines and with across sectors of the government that would be funded and have the authority to make sure breastfeeding happened in the country. Step two is that the 10 steps would be in place in all hospitals in the country. Number three is that the code of marketing, which is an international code that basically tries to fight misleading marketing practices, would be legislated in all countries. And the fourth thing is that there would be paid maternity leave and workplace accommodation for breastfeeding. And of course, the United States signed on to this in 1990, saying they'd do all these things by 1995. Okay. Recently, I asked what happened, because we signed it. When the country signs something officially, you expect something to happen. And I was told, well, it was a hortatory signature. Who knows what hortatory means? Hortatory, I had to go look it up, is when you get so caught up in the moment, like being at a football game or a baseball game, that you just have to sign it. And then you don't do anything about it. So anyway, that was where the 10 steps, that's the history of the 10 steps. Then along came Mr. Grant, who is he was a wonderful, wonderful leader. And he always felt, okay, we have something that's good. How are we going to turn it into a program that I can say, you go do this? And people at UNICEF and WHO wrote up the steps that a hospital would have to go through, that a country would have to go through to implement these steps. And that was known as the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative. I actually met Mr. Grant when he was thinking about this, and he said, Miriam, should we call it baby friendly or should we call it breastfeeding friendly? I said, oh, definitely call it breastfeeding friendly, because people would be offended, you know, if you say their hospital's not baby friendly. And he said, okay, we'll call it baby friendly. Ta-da, big impact I had. It was introduced in the United States in 1992. And then since that time, there's been multilateral fiscal support, i.e. WHO and UNICEF got support for it from many countries. And then more recently, when the money stopped coming in from several countries to UNICEF and WHO, magnanimously we said, okay, well now you countries can take it over, because we didn't have any money left. There's also been revisions in recent years to it to keep it a little bit more up to date. Today, more than 152 countries have at least some baby-friendly hospitals. That's about 28% of hospitals worldwide now have ever been designated. Some of them were designated and have fallen off, but that's how many have ever been designated. In developed countries, it's only about 8.5%. In the United States, we're just getting up to about 5%. Yay us. We're coming along. And this just simply illustrates that in where Mr. Grant had a hand in it, this was the progress. Where the countries had the decision-making, this has been the progress. So there's something to be said for a multilateral program, to be sure. And did it have an impact? Basically, Cheryl Abraham and I looked at the what was going on before. Here we go. We set up all the countries to say this was the moment that they started the baby-friendly hospital, had their first hospital designated. And we looked at the slope of the increase in exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months prior to their first BFHI hospital, and then the slope after, if I can get to that, after. And as you can see, neither of these slopes are significant. But the change is significant, and these slopes show a significant increase. So basically, we can at least show ecologically, that at the time that BFHI started up in these countries, exclusive breastfeeding took off. And yet in the United States, thanks to CDC, we know that we're still introducing a heck of a lot of formula, even in the first 2 days. There's a spare seat up here if anybody wants. This shows that more than 25% of infants who are breastfed still get formula for some reason while in the hospital. So something's going on in hospitals today that is still undercutting women's intention to breastfeed. We decided, rather than saying 10 steps or bust, we would take a stepwise approach and encourage the hospitals we were working with to look at steps and go forward in groupings of steps. Now, Catherine Sullivan, who is also sitting here, joined with us with this idea, and she, at the state level, instituted a program that gives a star for every two steps in place to the hospital. It's called the NCMC-BFD, which we all enjoy saying, which is the North Carolina Maternity Care Breastfeeding Designation. Right. What is it exactly?
North Carolina Maternity
Center. Breastfeeding-friendly designation. Okay, everybody? I know the NCMC-FBA. So we really took on the stepwise approach because of a couple studies that have been done, one by CDC and this one. I tend to show the studies I know better because I can talk about them more glibly. In this study, we looked at, from mothers' reports of the hospital practices, we saw which practices they reported and whether or not they achieved their breastfeeding intention. We assumed that there's 1 to 3 steps in place. And then the questions that mothers were asked covered these other steps, asking these questions that are listed here. What we found was once for every 2 additional steps, there was a significant increase in the number of women who achieved their exclusive breastfeeding intention even at 1 week postpartum. Isn't that sad to say only 14% of primips in so many hospitals were achieving their 1 week exclusive breastfeeding intention? So this was sent a strong message, and we proceeded apace. Let me tell you a little bit about the project then. As we saw earlier, the 10 steps seem to work. But this project was a little bit unique. There's a lot in the press about hospitals who decided to go after the BFHI, or in the United States, the BFUSA designation, and how they did it and that they succeeded. But there's not much in the literature, if any, about hospitals who were kind of wishy-washy about it or predominantly low-wealth. And we sought out those wishy-washy low-wealth hospitals to be in this study. To see what we could do in these settings. They weren't uninterested. Some of them were quite interested, but they were not selected because they were ready to roll. Emily's laughing because she had to get in there and make them roll. 6 participating hospitals were systematically assigned to 2 groups. One was the intervention in the first year, and the other did not get the intervention until the second year, so they served as the control in the first year. Data were collected from all the hospitals at baseline, at midterm after 1 year, and then after the second year of the study. It's not quite year, there was really 14, 16 month intervals, but that's approximately right. Data were collected included breastfeeding, exclusive rates, health worker KAP, and so on. This is the basic study design. Those of you who are familiar with quasi-experimental design will understand that this is what I just explained. Okay. Our interim findings were interesting enough. 8 out of the 10 steps had intervention-associated improvement, so there was some real improvement seen. Both breastfeeding and exclusive breastfeeding increased. We also looked at the 10 steps individually to see which of them were associated with the higher breastfeeding rates. And the steps that were most closely associated with any breastfeeding are listed here. Policy training, no supplements, restricting artificial nipple use. And it wasn't the same for exclusive breastfeeding. For exclusive breastfeeding, the immediate postpartum skin-to-skin popped into place. And it's interesting that that was so associated with the exclusive breastfeeding. Cue recognition and step 10, which is the outreach, did not come up in this early analysis. And that's probably because achieving exclusive breastfeeding in the hospital may not be so dependent on cue recognition because you're just supposed to be breastfeeding all the time. But it's very important after you leave the hospital, as is step 10. And just in case you haven't seen immediate postpartum skin to skin, here's some pictures for you, and the babies want it. Now, after this second phase, we've looked at the data, and Nathan, who's sitting in the Carolina blue shirt over there, did a lot of the analyses on these, in fact, all the analyses. And when we looked at it, we thought the best thing to do, since we really got very disparate numbers on our KAP in the first round, the second round, and the third round, was that we weighted it so each hospital would carry the same weight over time to allow more ready comparison. So what are the results? Graphic. Okay, this is the knowledge. A little bit of increase in knowledge in the early intervention group, kind of not so much ever in the second group. Attitudes, well, a little improvement in the first year in the intervention group, a little bit in the second year in the second year group. But practices improved in both groups. Now, what does it mean? Knowledge and attitude did improve, but practices improved. How would that be reflected in breastfeeding? What we saw, in fact, in any breastfeeding, the group that had the intervention in year one had a significant change during the year that they had the active intervention and continued to increase thereafter. The group that had the intervention in the second year actually went down in the first year, but went up at the same rate. If you look at the slopes of these two lines that are starred, you can see the slopes were almost the same. So the intervention had a very good impact. If you want to see the impact on exclusive breastfeeding, we see a very similar picture, where nothing much happening in the control in the first year, but significant in the second. What this tells us is that attitudes, knowledge and attitudes, may not be necessary before you make those practice changes that make a difference. That perhaps if you get people to do the right thing, the attitude will change thereafter as they see that they succeed. Now, this is not the way it's supposed to go in all of our training. First you train people, then you work on their attitudes, and then maybe practices will follow. So this was a very interesting finding for us. So the difference that we had, as I mentioned earlier, is that we did have low wealth and the hospitals weren't necessarily going after a designation. And we feel that this demonstrates the impact of hospital-specific interventions. And I didn't talk about this in great depth, but we tailored the intervention to the specific hospital. Knowledge and attitude did not significantly change as measured by our questionnaire in any case, but practice did. And isn't the proof in the pudding? The change in the rate of breastfeeding was reflective of the time of the most active intervention, and it did continue thereafter. So this lack of change in knowledge and attitude did not stop the practices from continuing in this case. Conclusions, way forward. I think it's important to know that improvements are possible in settings, even where people are not really all on board. And this actually was not what we were expecting, but it's really kind of an intriguing finding. It is reflective of many other countries where I've worked where they dictated baby friendly from above and people had to do it. And they had to do it, they did it, and more people succeeded with breastfeeding no matter whether they cared or not or had any knowledge or not. So just wanted to finish up by saying there's many reasons to act on this now. There's a list of them. Among other things, there's lots of reasons that we should be improving our hospitals now, if not the least of which is our wonderful new Surgeon General's report. And there are, as I don't have time, but you can see there's a lot of activities going on already. Just wanted to give proper acknowledgement to the team, also to thank Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust, Duke Endowment, and the task forces at each of the hospitals who worked with us on this. Thank you very much. And I think we still have time for questions. Oh, crowd of 17?